kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I'm your host, Joe. Fun show lined up today, and Cole Martin, you are here joining me. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm a little tired. I'm a little broken, but I'm alive. I'm probably not kicking at this point, but I am alive, and I'm here.
Nice.
Yeah. Some days that's the best you can roll with.
Very true. But we are not alone today. We are joined right now. Chris Alderson of PolyArt Games, you're joining us today. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing really great. We're about to launch our first game, so I'm on cloud nine right now.
So it just letting everything sink in that this is finally happening.
Yeah, we finished a build that we're really happy with Tuesday night around midnight, and now we're kind of learning what to do with ourselves now after working so hard to get over the finish line.
So
are there like endorphins just hanging around from the adrenaline rush of the crunch, the pre-launch?
Yeah, I don't know what's happening, but I think everyone in the studio is really excited for Tuesday, which is when we're launching. And we're in kind of this weird holding pattern. My body doesn't really know what's going on right now. It's used to working, you know, pretty long hours and devoting all of our energy to that singular goal of making this game as awesome as possible. So it's been an unreal, really amazing experience that I think everyone's just like ready to see what people think of the whole thing.
Nice. For the people who don't know, we should probably mention the name of the game. It is Moss for PlayStation VR. If anyone's listening who doesn't know what the game is, give us the sales pitch. What is Moss?
So Moss is an action adventure puzzle game that's coming out for the PlayStation VR that really utilizes the sort of physical interaction that VR has sort of like brought to the table as far as gaming standards goes. But it also stars this cute protagonist, Quill, who you help on her adventure as a reader in a library. You're basically reading the story of Moss, which is the world that this entire story takes place in, where you have to help Quill save a loved one that has been captured.
That sounds very, very intriguing. I put a little bit of time in with the demo that was on the PlayStation VR demo disc. And right off the bat, I got to say, why is the demo so short? I need so much more of the game.
That's basically what you just said is why it's so short. Because we definitely want people like wanting more. And we actually set out just to make a really good bite-sized portion of the game, like give everyone a little bit of a taste of what the game will entail, but not give so much that we're giving too much away, because we do have a lot more story and puzzles and adventure that the full release will have. We also needed to make that version of the game to sort of just understand for ourselves what Moss is, what kind of game we're making. And I think it just was a nice little like package that we were able to give people. And I think everyone, at least mostly everyone, enjoys it. You know, you always have outliers, but
they
I think
don't
we're
matter.
Really proud with they don't matter. No, we're really proud with the reception. It's we couldn't have dreamed for anything better.
Awesome. Sounds good. You mentioned that you're kind of trying to get used to what the game would be and what Moss would be. Did the demo start off as its own kind of building block, or was it part of the full game that you decided to set aside and make that the demo version?
Well, I feel like there's two parts to it. The first part is what we thought the game was going to be before we made the demo. And we had ideas based on a lot of prototypes we were making in VR, just like what a good VR game for us, like what does that mean? And the physical interaction of reaching into the world and grabbing objects and like being present within a world was really intriguing to us. But also the emotional reaction you can get by interacting with a character that can like look at you in the eyes or, you know, wave at you or give you a high five that you can like reach out and hold, which you can do with Quill. You can reach out and pet her and feel her heartbeat and actually have this emotional connection that you can't really have in a standard game. Like you can have an emotional reaction while playing a game, but There's something really special with having a character that's the right size, that's like right in front of you, that you want to nurture and care for. And so that was the kind of game we were making to begin with. And we were focusing a lot more on like, okay, you as a character in the game, how do you reach into the world and interact with it? But I got to say, we shifted a little bit based on just the reaction people made with or had with Quill. There were a few instances where people put on the headset and started playing and sort of quickly realized that Quill was the character they needed in their life that they didn't really know that they needed. And some people started crying and were like, oh, wow, like we need to double down on, you know, Quill and what makes her a living, breathing character. And so a lot of our focus sort of shifted into making her real and not just you real.
Mm-hmm. I love Quill, by the way. The first time I saw a cute little mouse walk out and then pull out a sword, I'm like, I'm going to love this game.
Yeah. And it was definitely, you know, as we were deciding what Quill's look and feel was going to be, we went in different directions. Like at one point she was a little bit more humanoid and kind of had a more cartoony look. But we weren't really getting that emotional connection. And so we sort of went back to a more like just traditional, like her proportions and her skeleton matches that of a real mouse. Maybe her arms are a little bit longer, so she has a little bit of room to swing her sword. But her face is that of a pretty much a, you know, anatomically that of a real mouse. And I think that's what people connect with. It kind of reminds them maybe of like a mouse that they had as a pet growing up. And so there are different things that like, okay, we'd do concept or we'd do a prototype and look at it and be like, okay, are we feeling anything? And it took a few iterations to kind of get to where she is now. But I'm definitely pretty happy with the way. It was the backpack, though. Once we added the backpack, we were like, okay, she's the character. She's definitely out to go on a cute adventure. So, yeah, we're really happy with the way Quill turned out.
So what's in the backpack?
In the backpack is where she keeps some of her trinkets. She's a very curious mouse. She likes to explore outside of sort of her village, which we call the clearing. And for pretty early on, you kind of get a sense of like what her interests are. But she also finds a relic, this piece of glass that is actually sort of like sets in motion the pieces of the story that gets Quill on her adventure and sort of like, you know, gets her into a little bit of trouble, but it also is the way that, she is sort of bound to you. And so that piece that she carries around in her backpack is actually how you help guide her and how you kind of follow her on this adventure.
Ah, so the backpack is actually used and not just a design thing.
Yeah, and our animator did an amazing job. Like, she actually will, like, take it off. And, you know, it's a lot of games will, like, you know, you'll have the character kind of reach behind you and, like, all of a sudden you have an object. She actually takes it off. And I think that's just another part of VR that sort of surprised us, is everything needs to feel a lot more physical. The two parts that we sort of realized are more important than they were. Like, everyone's role at the company is very important, but audio is a whole new way to do audio. It's just the way everything's spatialized, and you can actually feel the distance. If there's a bell ringing, you know, a mile down that you can hear, you actually feel that it's from over there, and you feel the rush of like the wind. And so we really focused on audio, and also, as I was touching on, animation. When a character doesn't feel lifelike, like if Quill didn't feel lifelike, there wouldn't be that emotional connection. And it's just a lot easier to kind of not get to the quality that you want if you don't have like top notch animation or audio in VR games.
The animation in this game is awesome. Mm-hmm. The first time that I saw Quill like pull herself up onto a ledge or like do kind of like the Dukes of Hazzard jump across the roof of the car, or the hood of the car type of deal, yeah, when she jumped up on a ledge. Like, this is awesome.
Yeah, I got a shout out to Richard Lico. He's our one animator. So every single animation that you see is all his. He's actually doing a GDC talk about it in a month, I think. Yeah, in about a month. So you should check that out.
Wow, so only one animator.
Yeah, yeah. I worked with Richard for, I think, 11 or 12 years now. And so not only like his animation, but also the way we're able to kind of riff on characters. Like, we had a lot of back and forth to kind of get Quill not only to like look the way we want her to, but also run and jump and, you know, do all the things that, that we want her to do to help that emotional connection. We worked pretty I think we have a pretty good relationship in that way. It was definitely not just the character creator. It's everybody had a big role in making Quill feel alive, like designers, animators, artists, engineers. And it was definitely a team effort.
It's impressive that it was only one animator on there. How big is the team? How big is the PolyArt crew?
So we are 15 in office. We have about, you know, four artists, one animator, an audio director, Steven. I got to call him out. He did an amazing job on this project. Three engineers, a handful of designers, and that's it. That's the whole team.
Wow. That is insane. This is such a gorgeous, fluid game, and to have such a small team, it blows my mind what developers can do these days.
Yeah, we're using the Unreal Engine, and that has definitely been an amazing experience. We're pretty close with those guys too. So if we ever like need features or anything, they're like, yeah, we'll look into it. And we've had them come over to the office and help us out too before. And I think a lot of it too is we hired an amazing group of professionals, like the most talented team I've ever worked with for sure. And a lot of us worked together at our previous studio, Bungie. I think there was probably like seven or eight of us that worked there together. So we already kind of knew about each other and how we work. And that definitely helped out. We're a bunch of collaborators, and we're all really happy to work with each other. So I think that helps. It's about the team, I think.
What made you guys want to?
It's a large game.
Yeah, I was gonna say, what made you guys want to set out from Bungie and do your own thing?
The medium of VR was sort of the thing that we all bonded over, and we decided that this was such an exciting opportunity to do something new and be sort of the forerunners of this new medium that we had to just go for it. I think it was a tough decision to leave Bungie for sure, but this has also been the most rewarding and fun project I've ever worked on, and also the hardest project for sure. I mean, it goes back to it being such a small team. It's never going to be easy when your team is only 15 people.
Yeah.
I think we all just heard the calling, and we had to give it a shot. I think the first time you put on a VR headset, something kind of, at least most people that I know, something grabs you, and it's just like, oh, wow, something is here. There's something new and exciting that I need to sort of explore. I think I can bring something to the table. For me, it was playing the demo with the, I don't know if you guys have ever done the blue, the one with the big whale. It was an early like Vive demo where this massive whale, you're underwater and you're already feeling like vulnerable. You're like, okay, I hope there's no sharks around me. Once you enter this VR experience, and this massive whale just comes out of, you know, the depths and comes toward you and just like looks at you in the eye. And you're like, I think that thing's looking at me. And you can like move your head and it follows you and it swims away. And it's only like a minute and a half demo, but something about it was like, oh wow, this, as a character creator by trade, I started thinking of like different ways that could be used. Something as simple as that. And once you start imagining all the things you can do and that by trade, by your medium, like what you're passionate about, it's really hard to think about anything else.
Yeah. I know my first VR experience, I believe, what was the soccer one that launched with PlayStation VR? Headmaster, is it? Something like that?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't play that one.
It was some kind of soccer, like headbutting soccer balls into a goal. That was the first VR game I played. My computer is awful, so I've never done Oculus or Vive. PlayStation VR is my only VR equipment, so I'm thrilled that Moss is coming to PlayStation VR. What made you guys go with PSVR over other platforms?
We've been around for about 2.5 years. I think that's how long PolyArt's been around. We did a Moss demo about like a few months into us starting the company. And it was really basic, but we did that and we took it around and just showed a lot of people. And when we showed Sony, they were pretty ecstatic about it. And just that right there was enough for us to be like, okay, cool. We want to try and work with these guys. And we heard great things about Sony too, from other studios that we know. And, they've just been amazing partners to work with. And so it was kind of a no brainer. They were as passionate about the project as we were. So, once you get that, then you feel like you're part of a team and you really feel like that, you should work together. So yeah.
Yeah, if someone doesn't share the passion for the game, it just doesn't, you know, they're not going to put their all into it.
Yeah, and they did. They showed early on that they were in. So we were in.
Nice. Is this a game that is pretty much just locked down to PlayStation VR, or can it appear on other platforms down the line as well?
Right now, we just focused on the PSVR. Maybe down the road. But yeah, right now we're still pretty focused on the PSVR release. We're still playing it and trying to see if there's any ways that we can manipulate it or break it. And so we might still be working on it for a little while.
Nice. We have a friend of the show, Carnage, who has a Windows 10 mixed reality headset, and he wanted us to obviously ask if it's going to hit Windows 10 mixed reality at all.
I don't know if I can comment on that.
So no comment on it.
Yeah.
No comment is always better than no.
I'm glad you like that answer.
We're pretty easy to please.
Yeah.
We are. We just like fun stories. So. Oh, man. So is this something that you guys from the beginning decided it was going to be a VR title, or did it start off as just a standard action platformer adventure? And then the VR came later.
No, this was definitely a VR first experience. We early on we were the VR thing is what kind of brought us all together to create this company and start making games. And so we set out to just try. In a new medium, you can't just expect everything that you know making games to carry across and just work. And so we made a point early on to just explore and try to do as many things as we can, and fail a lot. Like, failing is definitely a really important part in creating anything that's new and exciting. And so we failed a lot. We had a few successes. And the one thing that we all knew our game needed was that physical interaction, reaching into the world and like picking up an object and looking at it and being able to rotate it and understand it was such a cool experience for us that we knew our game needed that. And along that, just VR can take you to cool places, and it can give you emotional connection to the characters and the places that you go. That it was sort of the amalgamation of all these different tests and all the conversations that we had. That kind of like that's why the world was created, and that's why Quill was created. We knew we wanted a character that could fit within a world that you could physically interact with. If you're sitting down or standing up. We wanted the experience to be good for you, no matter what your setup at home is. Like, not everyone's ready to move all their furniture out of the way. A lot of people are going to be playing at home on their couches, and so we wanted to make sure our experience was comfortable in that way in VR. So that's sort of how Quill came about. Was her scale needed to be small enough to sort of fit within that world? Like, if you were to like reach out in front of you, like, how far can you reach? And we needed that to be the play space in which Quill can interact with. And so I'm kind of rambling, but as we kept going, we just kept deciding like what kind of parts of our, what do we want in our game? And so slowly that turned into Moss and turned into Quill. And we knew that we wanted you to be a character as well. And so that kind of like, that's how we figured out that you should be a character. And so all the things combined, we made this fairy tale story that we wanted to tell from the get-go. And so that's why that introduced the book aspect of it. And so it was really all these different parts that we've truly believed in that we kind of bound together to create this entire concept.
I gotta say, I had a very strong sense of immersion when I played Moss. I always know that it's a good game when I try reaching for something in the game and like my hands aren't there because it's a VR headset.
Yeah.
And then later on when I'm not playing the game, I honestly sat down at my computer earlier and I reached out with my controller to try and pull my keyboard tray out. And yep. I'm just a fucking moron because I tried doing it with a controller.
Yep. That's how you know it works. That's how you know it's a good experience.
That is definitely a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in our game. I've done this before in a couple other games, but I was in our game and I was in the library and I tried to put my controller on the desk within VR and totally missed the table. And I was like, okay, cool. We're doing a pretty good job. Time to move on to a different room.
That's not real. So. That is not real.
Exactly.
How many controllers did you break that way?
There's been a couple casualties, I gotta say. VR production is no joke. There's gonna be some casualties.
I've been dying to ask this. We've been covering VR on the show since the PlayStation VR released. We do interviews on the show all the time. We've never had a VR developer on the show. And I'm dying to know, what is the difference between programming something for a standard game with 3D visuals and depth and everything else compared to VR?
Yeah. So there isn't a lot of difference in the way that you create it. The big difference is getting someone to believe it. For me on the art side, a big focus was scale. If you know, a mushroom or a leaf or a stick just felt out of place, you just wouldn't believe that you're there. And one of the things we always ask our playtesters is, and we playtest a lot, is like, what brought you out of the experience? And so everything we do, like from the artists to the engineers to the designers, everything we do is trying to keep you within the experience and try to make it so you feel as comfortable as possible. Like comfort is a really, really important pillar of ours. And so from my side, like when you create something and you create the right scale and you're able to like put it within the game engine, the big difference is being within a place is a lot different than being outside of a place or watching it through the television screen. And so making sure that the scale and everything feels right, a lot of it is about feel. As far as game design goes, the pillars are all the same. Like a good game is a good game. But now you have this new interesting medium that you need to make sure that different things are communicated the right way. Now we're more like industrial designers. And you know, usually, you know, in a traditional game, you'll run up to a computer and you'll press X to hack it, and then that'll open a door and then you'll be able to go on your way. In VR, it's just not as satisfying of an experience to walk up to the same computer and just press a button and then everything works. That computer's right there in front of you. You should be able to like click on the buttons and like make it all work out. If you need to, you know, open a door, you got to make sure that it feels like you can reach out and grab the handle and pull it. It's all got to communicate really well to you. I think those are some of the differences. But as far as making a great game, like you still need to know how, you know, people react to certain circumstances. But I can't say that we know all the answers. I wouldn't say there is like one thing that makes a big difference. I think it's the, you know, all the small things that we've learned and all the tiny things that we've sort of, you know, we've done and done wrong and then done right that really makes a good VR experience.
Gotcha. I was thinking back a while back when Horizon Zero Dawn first came out. There was a GIF online that got popular of how, based on the camera angle, it would populate or unpopulate just areas of the world based on where you were looking. So if just behind you, nothing existed. I would have to imagine in VR, the entire world pretty much always has to be there, right?
Yeah, for the most part, you can look around and you're actually rendering everything twice. So you need to make sure everything's there two times. And so that's definitely a challenge as well. And that makes things a lot different than traditional gaming. And the fact that you're able to look around and look anywhere you want means you really need to help guide people's focus. Another thing we did that is a little different than most games that I've made is, you need to light everything in a certain way. So you like, it just leads your eye to that point that of interest that you really want them to focus on. But also like, you know, different tricks. Like you may remember from the demo, the butterfly flying leads your eye toward, well, Quill will arrive, and then Quill jumps over the block. And hopefully you're always paying attention to her at these certain story moments. But other times we want you to be able to like look around and experience the world. You know, it all happens right there in front of you, and you could miss something if you don't, you know, if you don't lead someone's eye to that point of interest.
Yeah. And that's something I did every time that I went to a new screen or new area in the game. I would immediately stand up from my couch and just kind of like look around the area that I was in and like peeking into things. And that's something I really enjoy about VR. Is that in most games you can't do that. Like if there's a corner there and the character walks down, based on the camera angle, you can't see what's down there. In VR, you could stand up and peek down that hallway and see what the hell's there. And it's so just so cool. Words can't really express how neat that is until you put a headset on and check it out for yourself.
Yeah, yeah, that's something that we really love about crafting this world, is that you can look around, but it also does make it very challenging. Yeah, you have to put a lot more effort into every little nook and cranny, because yeah, you can go wherever you want. And so, yeah, there's definitely a huge focus. And we do the stand-up test. We make sure you can stand up and look around. And we have someone pretty tall that works here. We call it the Peter test, because that's his name. And so he stands up. If there's something that looks off to him, then we know we need to fix it. But yeah, no, and that is really cool to be able to make a world that you can actually look around.
It's so fun. I love it. I love it. Cole, do you have any questions? I feel bad that I've been asking everything and you're just sitting there.
Like, I keep going to speak up and then you say something and I'm like, damn it, Joe. And
I
then
can't I help it. I'm excited to finally talk about VR on the show, because I'm the only one on the show who has VR. Yeah. Even including past co-hosts, it's pretty much just been me with VR. And even still, I'm limited. So I'm excited to finally get to ask some of this shit.
I am curious, like, how the decision for Quill to be the character she is, like, how did she come into fruition? Like, what just made you go, yeah, a mouse named Quill, that's a great idea?
Well, it never happens. I mean, sometimes a vision will come up and you'll be like, okay, cool, this is the blueprint, this is the starting point of creating a character that I think people will really bond with. And so the scale is really important, that a mouse would fit perfectly for that. We talked about different types of games we could do, like maybe they're toys or something, but nothing really helped give us that like connection or bond with the character that until we created Quill. And her name definitely came up a little bit later. And so it was definitely a journey to come up with her.
Where does the merchandising potential begin with Quill, by the way? Yeah. Are we going to see Quill plushies?
I would totally buy a Quill plushie, and I haven't even got to play the game.
Yeah. Yeah, we talk about it all the time. It just really depends on if people love the game. Hopefully when people buy the game and they play it, they really connect with it. And so one thing at a time. But that is definitely something we'd love to get into.
Some companies out there, they don't even wait for the game to release anymore. Yeah. I mean, look at Hello Neighbor. Before that came out, there was like Hello Neighbor plushies and posters and puzzles and everything. Like GameStop had a shitload of Hello Neighbor stuff before the game was even out. I guess it's good that it got popular. That would have been awkward if just no one played it.
Yeah,
I keep telling my husband I want one of the Nerax worms from Plague. And like, I'm just going to walk around with it sitting on my head. I love the Nerax worm. It's my favorite thing ever. But then I lost my question I was about to ask too, because Joe interrupted me and then I got to thinking about Nerax worms.
That happens to the best of us.
Yeah, and I'm not even the best, and I do it all the time. Damn it.
Oh, man. So the game is coming out on Tuesday. Again, I spent some time with the demo. How long is the full game going to be?
It's a few hours. We think most people, it'll be about roughly a 3-hour game.
All right. Any kind of replayability to it?
Yeah. Yeah. We have full trophies, a list of all the trophies that you can get. There's collectibles. There's the easier ones to get, the ones that you can kind of run through, akin to like, you know, Mario coins, but there's also like a tier higher that are more difficult to attain. And it's sort of like you were touching on standing up and looking around and being within this world. The harder ones to collect are definitely, you know, they lean more in that direction. Like just giving you reasons to sort of explore the world and look under things and look around pillars to see what you can find. And hopefully that is a reward within itself, but also we give you these little cookies that you can find along the way too.
Yay, cookies.
Yeah. We all love cookies.
I was just going to ask if any of the hidden collectibles or Easter eggs in the game are going to require you to actually get up and look around the world instead of just being in plain view.
They'll they'll make you look around. They'll make you work a little bit for it, but I don't think we'll ever require you to sort of like stand up or move beyond your comfortable play space.
Ever think of like putting, oh, go ahead. I'm letting you, I'm back here. I'm not going to say anything. Go ahead.
Are there going to be like any secret areas that people will have to do some special maneuvering to find or? Standing on your head or anything, but
no, nothing like that. I mean, there are definitely places that will be challenging to get to, but I wouldn't say it's like, you know, not too challenging. We wanted to make a really accessible game for pretty much anybody with a headset. And so yeah, that's my answer. But I gotta get back to the game, guys. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
It was a pleasure having you on. I wish we had more time. There's just so much more I would have loved to ask. Come back on sometime. It was great chatting with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
So do you have any final plugs you want to give? Where can people find out more about the game, find out more about you?
Yeah, so you can find out more about PolyArk on polyarkgames.com. And our game, Moss, is releasing on Tuesday the 27th, but you can get it basically at midnight, day of.
Sounds good. Is it digital only, or will we see a physical release?
It is digital only.
Any potential for a future physical release? I know that, you know, a lot of companies are doing limited physical versions of stuff.
I think anything's possible, but right now we don't have plans for that.
Sounds good. And how much is the game?
It is $30 US.
Sounds good. So Tuesday, everyone hit up the PlayStation Store, pick up Moss. Again, Chris, it was fantastic having you on and chatting.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Do you have any final words to wrap this up?
I hope everybody enjoys the game. We worked very hard and passionately on it. And so, we're really, really excited for people to jump in and meet Quill.
Awesome. Well, thank you again and have yourself a wonderful day, sir.
All right. You too.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I'm happy I finally got to talk to someone about VR on the show. I wish it could have been longer. It was, oh man.
It is what it is, but you got your shot.
Very true. Very true.
It's a good thing.
Oh man, we do have a lot more to take care of. A lot of news this week. I got to reopen all my stuff. I love the fact that right as we were about to start the show and start streaming, my computer decided to completely fucking crash. So like,
computer.
If anyone started the show and you heard me sound kind of frazzled and not really with it, it's because I'm still getting my shit together from my computer crashing 3 minutes before we were supposed to start the show. So yeah,
this time it wasn't me that was late. I was here. I got my kids off the bus. I handed them the remote control and I said, I gotta go record. Bye.
Yeah.
I haven't even fed them yet. David's supposed to bring home pizza.
That'll be fine.
Fend for yourselves. There's goldfishes in the cabinet.
they'll be fine. Just send them on their way. Oh, man. So news, a lot of news this week. Let's see. Probably the big thing to lead off, Games with Gold for March have been announced. It feels like they're announcing these earlier and earlier every month.
I think it only feels so early because it's February and there's just not as much extra time. Usually it's the last Tuesday or Wednesday of the month that they tell us.
Then next week would have been the last Tuesday.
Oh, then they're a little
early. They did it a whole week early.
They did. I'm okay with that. Maybe they're trying to trap people into buying for the next month.
Maybe.
They already know what they're going to get.
Decent lineup on Xbox. Xbox One, the entire month of March, we're going to have Trials of the Blood Dragon for free. And then March 16th through April 15th, Super Hot, which is a pretty solid game. So super hot. Super hot. Super.
I hate repetition.
Hot. Super. Xbox 360, March 1st through the 15th, Disney and Pixar's Brave the video game, which I thought was a very interesting choice for a freebie. And then the 16th through the 31st, Quantum Conundrum will be the freebie. So overall, a solid month. I'm kind of bummed because I already have everything.
Even Brave? You had Brave?
Yeah, I don't remember when I bought it, but I apparently had it from years ago, because I guess that could lead to new backward compatibility additions for the week. On Tuesday, they added three games to the backward compatible lineup, first one being Disney and Pixar's Brave the video game. So when I started up my Xbox and went to my ready-to-install list and I saw Brave sitting there waiting for me, I was very confused, but I'm sure I picked it up when it was on a super cheap sale the one year. So
my kids are excited about that, by the way, because they still use the 360. So nice. They get extra use out of the 360 games. And so they were all like, I got Brave. So
nice.
Being happy, I guess. Get me some gamer score. Love you, boy.
Jesus Ninja in the chat saying it's all new games for him. So that is always a good month of games with gold. When you get 4 of 4 brand new games that you haven't owned, that's a good month.
Yeah, I'm at 3 out of 4 because I had Trials of the Blood Dragon.
Nah.
But I did not have the others.
Oh, that means you could finally play Super Hot.
Yeah.
Super Hot. Super Hot. Super. Two other games were added to backward compatible list this week. Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light was added. So if you're looking for some more isometric twin stick pew pew Tomb Raiden, that is available for you. And then Vanquish, which I know a lot of people are excited about.
I don't know anything about that one, I don't think.
What? You got
that might be a case of where, like, I recognize the title screen or something, but I don't actually have a history with the game.
Oh boy. Some other news this week. I'm thrilled. Burnout Paradise Remastered is finally official. It is coming out March 16th. $40 will be 4K, 60 frames per second, include all the DLC. People could bitch all they want about all these remasters and re-releases and everything else. I can't fucking wait for Burnout Paradise Remastered.
I feel like this may be one of the remasters that people were genuinely asking for, and not going to be a lot of bitching about this one.
I mean, people want more Burnout. We've wanted more Burnout for years, and instead EA decided to make Criterion do Need for Speed and then Need for Speed, and then they pretty much just dismantled Criterion, so now they're like an assist company that just works on other shit. I want Burnout back. Fuck Need for Speed. I'll put that out there. Fuck Need for Speed. Give us Burnout. Brand new Burnout.
I haven't played the new Need for Speed, but I generally like the series. The one before this one, I bought it, but I waited till it was on sale for like $6.
Yeah, that's about what it was worth.
I don't know, I felt off to play. And then once they added all like the Hoonigan stuff, just drives me nuts. I'm no good at that. And I felt like I couldn't get anywhere because that was all I had left.
The last one before Payback, just with all the live action, cringy, awful.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, there was a lot of cringe in that one.
What was the one guy just kept calling the girl Bay all the time? Like, fuck off. Oh my god. I wanted to beat the shit out of him.
And you couldn't skip the cutscenes for shit. So I just like put the controller down, walk away, and come back. My car be sitting there and be like, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Jesus Ninja saying Need for Speed is trash. Last one I enjoyed was Underground. I think the last one I really enjoyed was Need for Speed Most Wanted, the one that Criterion did. And then that was the just one, garbage.
What was the one before the live action one?
I don't remember.
I don't know.
They put out too goddamn many Need for Speeds. There's just too many of them. There's too many of them. They all blur together. Everyone buy Burnout Paradise Remastered so that EA will get the hint that we want fucking Burnout and we don't want more Need for Speed. Because again, fuck Need for Speed. Give us Burnout. Our old co-host Chris was thrilled at this one rumor going around that apparently Blizzard is working on a Switch version of Diablo 3. So when I shared the link with him, he's like, dude, oh my god, fucking dude, man. Oh, that would be so awesome. The rumor is that it's going to release in early 2019, so probably a good year away, and that they are aiming to include local play with multiple Switches. Again, this is a rumor, zero confirmation, so it very possibly may not happen, but if it does, that'd be cool as shit.
It does sound interesting. I have never played Diablo.
You should.
At this point, me saying I have not played an older game shouldn't come as a surprise at all.
True.
But I did not play Diablo.
Yeah,
you I don't should. Even know anything about it. Like, I could recognize the title, again, the title card. If I saw it, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's Diablo. I know that. I don't know jack else.
Yeah, you need to fix that, because Diablo 3 is one of the games I probably put more time into on Xbox than nearly anything but Rock Band at this point.
I was about to say, how does it hold up to your time with Rock Band?
Oh, God. I kind of wonder how much time I've put into Diablo now. I know it's nowhere near what Chris has done, but I know I put a nice chunk into it. I'm going to look that up. I don't even give a shit. Some other Switch news is that Payday 2 is finally releasing on the Switch this week, which I'm sure Chris is excited about that as well, because he loves Payday. But people are already kind of pissed about the game, because they did some digging. Some people who already had early access to the game found that it is running version 1.17, which might not mean much to a lot of people, but the current PC version is 172. So it is 55 updates and over 2 years behind the current PC build of the game.
Wow. I think that's even PlayerUnknown's isn't that big of a gap between Xbox and the PC version.
Yeah. I mean, the Payday devs have never had a good track record of having console versions anywhere near on par with the PC. And you know, the original Payday 2 on 360 and PS3 never got an update, I don't think. I think it just released, and then that was it. And then
that's not good.
Yeah, and then they brought it to Xbox One and PS4, and people were concerned because they didn't do shit with the last-gen version. And then they ignored it for, I don't know, a good year before they started finally releasing DLC and extra content.
Yeah, I do remember when all the extra stuff released for it, and everybody was like, oh my god, they're going to pay attention to it now. And I don't think they did pass that.
Yeah, so people are definitely very worried about whether or not they're actually going to keep the Switch version with frequent updates and patches. Because 2 years behind is ridiculous.
Yeah, that's not good.
I don't know how, I don't know. Oh, let's see. Capcom confirmed that Mega Man Legacy Collection 1 and 2 will be hitting the Switch May 22nd, and you can unlock extra challenges with the Mega Man Amiibo, which is nifty.
More Amiibos, or is the Mega Man Amiibo already a thing?
And this it's been a thing since Smash Brothers, and then the first Mega Man Legacy Collection, when it released on 3DS, they sold a special bundle with a gold Mega Man Amiibo.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And of course, I have it. The retail version of Legacy Collection is going to be a fun little bundle, because Legacy Collection will be on a cartridge, and then Legacy Collection 2 will be a download code. It feels like it should be the other way around, considering that like Legacy 1 is only 500 meg and Legacy 2 is like 5 gig.
Yeah.
Feels like they should, you know, put the bigger one on a cartridge and download the smaller one, but oh well, what are you going to do?
I know nothing about what cartridges are limited to or any of that. Well, I am worst gamer ever. I either haven't played this or I don't know that.
you got to read up on the Switch, because we talk about the Switch a lot on the show.
I know. That's what I keep saying. I need to do more research. Maybe I need to win one, and then that way I'd know what I was doing with it.
No, it won't be from us, because I'm not giving away a fucking Switch. A quick update, 13 days, 20 hours, and 2 minutes on Diablo 3.
Damn.
So, yeah, put a nice chunk of time into that one. Lawmakers in Rhode Island have proposed new legislation that will tax video games rated M or higher, so M or AO, an additional 10% sales tax, with the tax going to help pay for mental health and counseling resources for,
where was this?
In Rhode Island.
I have feels about this.
You can't mumble. You gotta use your radio voice.
I don't have a bigger voice because I have feels.
Well, it's just, you'll talk and then you'll be like this, and then I can't.
You know. That's because I have feels.
What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, there needs to be better funding for mental health, but what the fuck does one have to, like, it feels like it's adding a stigma of tying mental health to video game, like, mature rated video games. Why?
They're trying to link video games to the recent school shooting that happened. You know, people in Florida are trying to blame violent video games. They've been trying to pull this shit for years of violent video games cause violent people. No, how about the fucking culture that we're in right now where we have a racist bigot cocksucker is the president who, you know, just basically turns a blind eye to hate crimes and race crimes. And it just happens. And we're at this awful time in history where we're seeing shootings on almost what, weekly, daily basis anymore. And it's just, oh, again, it happened. There's no outrage anymore. There's no anger anymore. It's just, oh, another one.
Oh yeah. Here's the thing with the stigma, and I'm probably going to veer a little off topic here, but they're tying the stigma of mental health to playing mature rated games, but they're also tying this mental health argument to gun violence. You know, it makes a big ass circle is what I'm trying to say. There are millions and fucking millions of Americans with mental health issues, and they don't go shooting shit up. They don't. My husband is bipolar. He has never shot up anywhere. He doesn't even own a gun. We have no guns. We have a gun. It's not here. We keep it elsewhere because he's bipolar. It's not, you know, it just fucking makes sense. It's behind a lock. It's disassembled. It has to be loaded through the fucking muzzle. It's not something he can't, it's not an AR-15.
No.
And it shouldn't be. Because one, if you need an AR-15 to take down a goddamn deer, you don't need to be in the woods anyway.
No.
That's my redneck side.
I love that people, when
this whole stigma being tied together, and it fries my nerves.
Yeah, when people try putting the blame of gun violence on video games, how about the fact that, you know, there's no actual gun laws, and
there is a law on the books that the CDC can't even gather data about gun violence. They can't even research how to better treat gun wounds because of this law. We've been using the same kind of treatment methods for gunshots for fucking decades. That's disgusting. That's absolutely disgusting. There's no reason for there not to be research and statistics and improved treatment for this.
No.
We're perfectly fine sending, you know, lambs to slaughter with AR-15s because, well, that's all right, but we can't even, like, figure out how to treat them after this fucking happens? Why is this okay? And why does it all get blamed on the mentally ill? And why is it? I have questions, Joe.
Well, this is not the show for those questions.
I know it. I know, and that's why I'm trying to stop myself, but... You pushed my button.
Well, it's news that happened this week. I think it is a good thing. The world needs more resources and more ways to help those who need mental help and who need counseling. You know, if people were involved in something like the tragedy that happened, they need those outlets mm-hmm. there to help them. But taxing video games isn't the way to tackle this issue. Maybe. How about, you know, don't repeal legislation that made it harder for mentally ill people to buy guns. you fucking asshole in the White House. How about that?
Maybe we could buy less guns for the military.
Why?
We need that money we save.
We need more pew-pews.
More pew-pews. But in all reality, like, it's not the show for it.
It's fucked up. It's fucked up. Anyway, last bit of news I have. Mixer is going to be introducing a direct purchase feature soon. Did you see this?
I did.
So if someone is streaming a game that is available on Xbox or Windows 10, you'll be able to just buy it on Mixer and it's in your library. You won't have to leave the stream. You just handle everything there. And then the content is automatically added to your Xbox or Windows 10 library. Streamers will also earn 5% of every purchase that happens on their channel. And they'll be able to select what kind of content is featured between, you know, the game, individual DLC, or if there's like a collector edition, deluxe edition, whatever else, so that you can pick whatever content you're trying to feature and trying to sell to your viewers. This looks to be only for those who are partnered with Mixer. So little Jimmy Nobody can't just start streaming GTA for the first time and get paid.
So yeah.
You got to earn that shit. You can't just jump right into making money.
The ability to purchase games is on Twitch as well, and it benefits the streamer.
Yeah.
But it's limited, whereas, like, it's limited to, it's Steam, that right?
I think it's the Twitch game client, because even with Amazon Prime, you get free games on Twitch.
Yeah. But you can't buy Xbox, and the ability to buy Xbox games is kind of what's pushing Mixer over the top there, because you can, you know, Xbox or Windows.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice little bonus.
I wonder if it's going to work the same on the Mixer app on the Xbox One. So if you're watching someone stream, you could just immediately buy a game and download it right from the stream. I think that would be cool.
I would think so. Yeah, I would think you would. I don't know why that would be any more difficult to add.
I don't know. Maybe I don't know.
What do I know? I think they have the interactivity though, right? Like if you've got a sound bar or whatever for interactivity and you're on the Xbox, you can still see the streamer's sound bar. So if they could handle that, surely to goodness.
Oh, you can have that stuff on the Xbox app. See,
I'm about 97% sure. Yes.
I don't watch too many Mixer streams on my Xbox. And when I do, it's usually, you know, just the video. I don't mess with any of the interactivity stuff. I'll do that on my computer. I don't watch streams often on my console, whether Mixer or Twitch. That's what my computer's for, you know, when it's not crashing.
Yeah, the same way. I think the only time I'm really, that I tend to watch streams from the dashboard is if it's like a live event, like E3 or something like that, then I'm like, oh, I'll just load it up to that, because that's when everybody in the house wants to watch it. Well, that too. But like everybody in the house will want to watch that. Whereas if I'm watching, you know, some of my favorite streamers, that's something that's just me, and my husband and my kids don't particularly give a fuck. So I'm usually, you know, like have the computer on and have found headphones or something for that, as opposed to blasting it on the TV through the whole house.
Yeah. Anyway, that's the news I got for this week. Any news that happened this week that you want to bring up?
No, if I had anything, I forgot it because you got me on a tangent. So,
well, that is not my fault. I'm just talking about the news of the week. But let's jump into reviews then. We got some games to talk about. The first one we're going to talk about tonight is called Rad Rogers, developed by Slipgate Studios, published by THQ Nordic, released February 21st on Xbox One and PS4 for $19.99. After dozing off at the tail end of a long night of gaming, Rad awakens to find his dusty old console has turned itself back on. Suddenly, a vortex emerges and he's sucked into his TV, where he finds himself the star in his very own video game adventure. Dusty is Rad's good-hearted but foul-mouthed, now sentient game console. His clock speed isn't what it used to be, but what he lacks for in megahertz, he makes up for with experience and attitude. So, you know, a sentient game console with attitude.
Please tell me it dropped F-bombs.
I see the game is rated M for violence and language, but I haven't really seen too much in the game to really push an M rating. Like, you know, there's some profanity, like the kid will say, let's go kick some ass, or I've heard bullshit and shit in the game. I haven't really heard any F-bombs unless I'm just missing them. The violence isn't anything super gory over the top. Part of me thinks they kind of just went M-rated on this to make it an M-rated game. This easily could have been something that was teen, and I don't know. I don't think it would have affected the game that much. But yeah, Rad Rogers is a 2D action platformer, very similar like the old school Commander Keen and Duke Nukem games, like the old school 2D platformer ones, not the first person Duke Nukems. You go stage through stage, find every stage you have to find four pieces of this little amulet that you use to exit the stage. So once you collect all those and get to the exit, you could leave the stage. Every stage has a number of secret areas and secret collectibles, gems to collect, enemies to kill. And the one thing I enjoy is that in this game, the enemies per stage are limited. They don't have endlessly respawning enemies. There's even an achievement in the game for killing every single enemy in the game. So, you know, when you end a stage and you get the totals of like, you collected this many gems, you collected this many secret areas, you killed this many enemies, you're trying to make sure that you collect and kill everything. So, you know, you 100% it. It's not a super huge game. There's, I don't know, a dozen or so stages. There's some side stages. I ran into like a pogo bouncing mini game on the one stage where you kind of just do like a vertical, you know, doodle jump. Have you played that game on your phone?
No.
No, where you basically just jump from platform to platform on your way up. And it's kind of similar to that where you're collecting gems on the way up and you're just trying to survive a climb to the top. Gameplay, it's fun. It can control either, you know, standard run and gun, or you could use twin stick controls if you want to be a stationary shooter. Otherwise, if you're moving running and gun and you're just going to, you know, you can't really aim that well, you'd have to twin stick it. Go through stages, collect everything, end the stage, move on. Visually, it has nice look to it. They have... It's a more modern look and more modern visuals to it, but there's a lot of pixelated throwback icons and moments. There's certain stages and levels you're going to have to go into like a more digital side area. Like the game console will go into this network. I don't know what the fuck it is. Just like a dark realm or whatever. And you have to like, you know, make a platform appear or, you know, destroy a boulder or something to clear your way. Just ways to freshen up so it's not just run, gun, move on. It keeps things moving, keeps things interesting. The stages, levels can be huge. I've already put 20 minutes on a single stage. So while there's not a ton of stages in the game, they are, you know, they're meaty stages. There's a lot of content there. And all the hidden items, lottery playability, trying to go back and find everything. I know Little Triangle, we mentioned, had some hard-to-find secret areas. Rad Rogers is another one of them, where I hug every wall. I look for every secret I can, and I beat a stage with 4 out of 10 secrets found. Like, what the fuck am I missing? There's just so much in the game to find and to do. $20 for it. I think there is enough content to justify the price. Clearly the M rating might turn some people off, but it's not really a super M rated game. Like this is one of those games that make you think that there should be another rating in between T and M.
Yeah. Like a young adult type rating.
Yeah. Because, you know, you compare Rad Rogers to Grand Theft Auto 5 or like Dead by Daylight, it no comparison. Rad Rogers is so much more lighthearted and more accessible than something like Grand Theft Auto. It really does feel like it's M-rated just to have an M rating. And it feels completely unnecessary. And I'm someone who, I enjoy my violence and my cursing, as you can tell by all the fucking cursing I do on this show. But yeah, $20, I give it a solid try. A lot of fun, lots to do. Just, it's not a world changer, and the M rating doesn't feel necessary. But otherwise, a lot of fun. No comment, or why?
No. I thought you were going to add something else. Like, it didn't quite sound like an end, and so I was like, okay. Sounds good.
All right, next game to talk about is called Claybook, developed and published by Second Order, released February 16th to Xbox One Game Preview for $14.99. Claybook is a unique world made entirely of clay. Every inch of the environment can be shaped and molded. Everything is matter inside it, not just an outer shell. Shape your character and the world around you to overcome challenging obstacles. Cole, tell me about this one.
Okay, so Claybook is basically a world made out of Play-Doh.
Cool, next game.
It does, yeah. I'm not done. What are you, Carnage? So basically,
don't make me get him on here.
He's chomping at the bit to interrupt me. Everything is made of Play-Doh, essentially, but each individual world of Play-Doh is set inside of a chapter of a book. You are
everything's made of clay. Play-Doh is a trademark. It's clay.
Okay, well, it's clay that looks conspicuously like Play-Doh. So with everything made out of clay, you actually take on the form of a little clay ball to start with. You're being moved around the world by a little child with a joystick. I've never seen a joystick that could control a lump of clay, but we're going to roll with it. and we're going to literally roll with it. God, I hate myself. Carnage came out there. As you roll around the world, you'll have some objectives that will come up. Usually they're pretty simple to start with. Clear out enough of the clay so that a clay fluid can move from one container to another, for example. And in order to do this, you'll need to change the shape of your clay ball. You can change into a square or a cylinder. All kinds of different little items will eventually become available. And every shape has its own benefit. So if you need to knock down the wall of a container, you'll want to be in the shape of a cube because it's going to knock it down more quickly. In order to eat away at the clay and kind of remove it, and you almost kind of like absorb it into your own existing state as whatever you are. In order to do it more quickly, you'll want to hold down the right trigger and then you just kind of like spin like mad. And that will help remove some of the clay. You can also add clay by leaving a stamp of yourself. In order to do this, you pull the left trigger and it kind of, instead of just like leaving a stamp of clay where you are, it leaves the stamp, but it also rewinds time and resets you somewhere else. Depending on how long you hold the trigger is how long it will, roll you back for. And then you can attempt to, cross gaps this way or to redirect the flow of fluid or whatever you need to do. It's the stamping is really odd though, and it can be a little difficult if you leave a stamp somewhere to then come back and get over the obstacle of the stamp without just completely obliterating it. And that kind of leads to my greatest complaint is that it's really easy to fuck up the world because it is all just clay. And so every surface that you touch, every surface that you roll over, whether you're doing the little spin to try to actually remove the clay or not, you're going to leave divots and dips and potholes in the world. Which is neat from a physics standpoint and is a pain in the ass from an objective standpoint because some of these objectives are up in the air and you'll need to roll over things like tiny little bridges and or you just it's a, an utter pain in the ass if you're trying to get to an objective and you're not very good at controlling your clay like me. And you fall off a lot and you got to go back. And then you fucked it up now because you've done rolled over it 74 times and the bridge is gone. And so then you just have to give up and restart the whole chapter because you're not getting to that last piece of chocolate you're supposed to eat.
Yeah.
Which is just a pain. All of that aside, though, like the actual difficulty of some of the levels, I think you were talking about you had trouble with the rocket ship.
Yeah, control in the game is probably one of my biggest gripes. It seems like when the one achievement in the game requires you to pilot a rocket for a bit, and that was the most maddening 10 minutes of my life I've ever spent trying to get that goddamn achievement with that fucking rocket. It's like I couldn't do it. I saw Bill's has a video of it on True Achievements, and I watched him, and he did it in like, I don't know, 10 seconds, and I'm just sitting there hating him that he was able to do that quickly. Even just traversing areas because of the clay wearing away, and even the momentum of the clay obstacle that you're controlling, it makes moving around so difficult sometimes.
It does. And one of the other problems I had is in instances where there was the fluid clay, which is just more blue clay, but it moves on its own. The greatest problem I had was there are some levels where that blue fluid just builds up and builds up and builds up. Of course, every time you're rolling by or you're trying to get through it, you're leaving divots, and that just lets the clay get deeper and deeper and deeper. And before you know it, you can't get anywhere you fucking needed to go. And you're having to restart again. And then again. And then again. And everybody keeps talking about how this game is an easy completion, and I'm just like, how did you move the fucking clay? I can't do it. But if you are a completionist or if you're an achievement whore and you're looking for some quick, relatively simple gamer score, you're not going to be let down here because there are only 10 achievements worth 100 G each.
Yeah.
And this may be the game's greatest aspect.
I mean, visually, it's a gorgeous looking game.
Yes.
Music's cute enough. It's fun. It's enjoyable. It reminds me a lot of Katamari without the whole collection aspect.
The little creepy dead-eyed kid in the background can kind of throw you off sometimes.
Yeah.
And he's just sitting back there staring wide-eyed at whatever he's doing with his little joystick, and you're just like, okay, kid. No. I'm going to turn the camera this way. I will say, my kids had a blast, and they, of course, they didn't care about the achievements, and they didn't even care about the objectives. They were just looking to see what they could do to the worlds, which was really, really neat to see. Like, they just wanted to dive in and move the clay, which was cool, because I don't like Play-Doh, and I don't want that shit in my floor. So now I can just be like, here, have a controller, and I don't have to clean up Play-Doh.
Yeah, and there is a sandbox mode in the game as well to just fuck around. There is,
yeah.
But
yeah, you can edit and all that good stuff.
I know content might be the biggest issue, but considering it's in game preview, I'm sure more will be added over time. That's kind of the point of it.
There are two books currently with 10 chapters per book, if I'm not mistaken. So that's approximately 20 different levels plus the sandbox.
Yeah. So $15 on this one. What do you think?
I give it a pretty hearty try, especially if you've got kids and small kids who, you know, aren't going to care about the objectives and just want to play around. They're going to have a blast.
Nice. Sounds good. I would give it a try it as well. It's cute. It's fun. My concern will be the amount of content and just the control issues and even the camera control issues. A lot of minor frustration with the game for me, but $15.
I'd like to see it be polished up. Yeah, I'd like to see it be polished up a little more before it comes out of preview. Yeah.
Which is the point of game preview, is to, you know, release it and polish it up. And we don't know if the price will go up or not, but I would imagine it could, since a lot of the game preview titles have had their prices increase. So if you want to get in while it's cheap, $15, I agree, is definitely worth a try. It.
Yep.
Next to talk about is called Jurassic World Pinball, developed and published by Zen Studios. DLC pack released February 20th on Xbox One, Switch, Steam, Windows 10, PS4, $9.99. A collaboration with Universal Brand Department, Zen Studios celebrates the 25th anniversary of Jurassic Park. Oh my God, I'm old. This pack of prehistoric pinball perfection, a lot of peas, is comprised of three thrilling tables themed around the history and lore of the iconic film franchise, including actual film dialogue. This is a really, really, really fun pinball pack. Three tables are included. I'll go over each one. Jurassic World Pinball, clearly themed after the new movies. A large table, a lot of cool ramps, lots of stuff going on. Beautiful visuals on it and all of the tables. Really, really good looking game. I enjoy the fact that in Pinball FX3, it's not just the table, but like the surrounding area has, it feels like it's just part of a world that everything's in. Jurassic World Pinball is probably the one I actually played the least of, despite the fact it might be one of my favorites of the pack. I tried to put a fair amount of time into each of them, but some of them I just got more addicted to than others. The Jurassic World one, I enjoyed hearing the clips from the movie. It's interesting to hear Chris Pratt in a pinball game, but it works. enjoyable table. Jurassic Park Pinball is based off, obviously, the very first movie. A very small feeling table. Like I had a sense of claustrophobia playing the table. It feels a lot more basic than Jurassic World, a lot more smaller, more compact. I also seem to lose a ball down the middle. One of those like unavoidable, like the ball just drops straight down the middle. No way to save it. It happened way too frequently on that table. Did have some pretty good scoring opportunities if you're into high scoring games. I know even the challenges on there, like the first game, I think I scored like 400,000. I'm like, wow, I did pretty good. And then I did the one challenge. It's like hit 12 million. I'm like, fuck you. Honestly, the Jurassic Park pinball, the original Jurassic Park pinball might be my least favorite of the three pack, but it's still overall a decent table. Hearing the original voice clips from the just Jeff Goldblum in a pinball table is always fun. And then the third one is Jurassic Park Pinball Mayhem, which it feels more like it's an out in the open kind of thing. There's a lot more empty space in the table, which isn't a bad thing. But it also felt like it was really hard to hit some of the ramps. There would be, like in Pinball FX3, there's a mode where the challenge is like you have a minute to hit a certain point threshold and then it restarts and you have another minute. Or they have a 5 minute, just get as high a score as you can. And when you have a time crunch and you just keep hitting and it's not doing anything, you kind of get worried, like, should I just restart? Is this worth trying? And with Jurassic Park Pinball Mayhem table, it seemed fairly hit or miss whether I was going to get massive points on a table or on a run, or if I was just going to hit it off of rails for 5 minutes and get 12 points total, something like that.
I think like me with every pinball. It's like, hey, I got 50 points.
out of the three pack, I think the Pinball Mayhem one is my favorite. They have some really cool side games and side missions you could do in that one. A lot of massive point opportunities in there. I think the one high score, not only did I like match all the point goals that you had to do, you can earn like 15 up to 15 levels for each of the three challenge modes on a table. And Pinball Mayhem was the very first time I actually got all 15 stars on the 5 minute challenge.
Damn.
Yeah. I've been playing FX3 since it launched, and today was the day that I got that 75 gamer score achievement for getting all the stars. And it was in a single game. So it was,
that's impressive.
It was fun. Overall $10. I think this is definitely worth picking up. The Jurassic World table is really good. The Pinball Mayhem is my favorite of the pack. Just the standard Jurassic Park pinball. despite the fact that it feels smaller and more claustrophobic, it's still an enjoyable table. I don't think that it's the worst of the pack makes it a bad table. It's still a fun table. It's just there's two other really, really good tables in there it has to compete with. But three tables, $10. If you're into pinball, absolutely worth picking up.
Thanks.
Next game to talk about is called Past Cure, developed and published by Phantom 8 Studio. Released February 23rd, Xbox One, Steam, PS4, $29.99. Past Cure is a cinematic, story-driven experience where the player follows the struggle of a broken man searching for the missing pieces of his mind. With intense cutscenes and intriguing story items throughout the levels, the players can unravel a story that will keep them guessing to the end. Dark Mika covered this one, sent in the email. You're going to read this one because my throat is dry.
I am reading this. All right, let's go. Past Cure is a third-person first FPS. It's a third person shooter.
I don't have the email up. You're on your own with this one.
It says third person FPS, so I think she means third person shooter.
Probably.
With a few puzzles mixed in. You play as Ian. You woke up in the streets of London with no memory of the past 3 years. You also happen to have some really freaky powers. Astral projection.
It does say third person FPS. That's funny.
Astral projection and time dilation, slowing the time of things around you. He spent a year learning to control these powers to a degree with the help of his brother, Marcus. They've also been trying to find leads about what happened to Ian in the 3 years he's missing. The game starts around the time a semi-solid lead is finally found. The game is really good looking, however, it uses mostly whites and grays. The real world is mostly white, splashes of colors, but mostly just white and light grays, with his psychosis-driven nightmares are mostly blacks and dark grays. It gives a nice contrast to each other. That being said, there's not a lot of different environments in a game. There's 7 levels total, which took me around 13 to 14 hours to beat. As such, the levels aren't short. Each level is a different area, but there's not much variety in each individual area, which was kind of sad. Granted, most of the time, it makes perfect sense. It's just sad because with how nice the game looks, it would have been nice to see more variety. Gun combat is fun and fairly easy. Each gun even has its own reticule, so you don't have to look as to see which gun you have equipped. You can just as easily recognize what you have equipped by what crosshair you see on the screen, which was really awesome.
Isn't it fun trying to read her review sometimes?
There's a little variance in reticules, but not much. This game, they're completely different. There's a little variance in reticules, but not much. Okay. Reading are hard. Hand-to-hand combat is a pain in the ass, though, as you have to hit the punch button to a specific timing and then push a finisher button to end the fight faster. It's timed as well, and that time is up rather quickly. I know what they were getting at with it, but it requires the player to move a bit too fast to do anything with. You'll regularly mess up. The gun mechanics, which is what you use most of the time anyways, is on point, though. And there's a nifty little stealth kill system, which is what I used for more than half the game, because it's really fun and makes the game a bit easier. The story is interesting, but it's also not fully explained, and what is there is rather convoluted and hard to follow. All I got out of most of the story was go here, do this, why, because reasons. I guess it makes sense since Ian is trying to find information about why he can do what he's able to do and to figure out what happened to him in the missing 3 years. So he doesn't really understand anything either. He's just grasping at straws as you're as the player just there for the ride. She didn't fuck that line up. I did.
Technically it should be, and you as the player are just there for the ride, not you're as the player just there for the ride. I'll grammar Nazi this motherfucker. I don't care.
Oh, Mika's getting a red pen treatment. I still got 2 more paragraphs to go.
I have teacher friends. I will get someone on her. Anyway.
The only real issue I had with the story, besides that it's hard to follow, is that it doesn't really answer anything. There's no closure to any of the questions that were asked at the start of the game. Instead, it gives you more questions. That aspect of the game annoys me because the game didn't feel like it did anything by the end, since it didn't answer any of its own questions. That being said, as much as it annoyed me, as much as it left me with more questions, I'm now really intrigued and want to know the answers. So I guess it did what it was supposed to do. It pulled me in and it didn't let go. For $30 on the X1, PS4, and Steam, I think it's worth it. Its gameplay is really fun, its environments are beautiful, and its gun mechanics are really cool, especially with time dilation. I played it on easy and died a few times, so I can't even imagine how hard it'll be on the hardest difficulty. It will give it will definitely give those who want a challenge that challenge. However, it's also a short game, and its story is left unfulfilled, so it's not mind-blowing. It's not a full-price game. At half-price, a standard game, I don't think it's asking too much.
Sounds good. I know that game has been, like, getting destroyed in reviews. It seems to be a real hit or miss one. Reddit had a review thread going for Past Cure, and there's, like, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 5, 2 out of 10. It seems to be a real hit or miss style game. So
it was one I kind of expected to get to review from somewhere. And so I was like, this one's going to land in my lap. And the developers even followed me on Twitter. I didn't review the game, though. I didn't do it anywhere. So I missed out. I probably would have. It sounds like something I would have been really into.
Maybe. Seems like Mark Meek enjoyed it. So
pick it up anyway.
It's good to hear that she enjoyed it. After hearing so much other negativity about the game, it's good to hear that she really enjoyed it. So just goes to show you that opinions are like assholes. Everyone has them, and yours is really shitty. So
I always heard that everybody stinks. So that's a different way to phrase it.
I like my version. Anyway, next game is called Xenon Valkyrie Plus, developed by Diabolical Mind, published by Cowcat, released February 21st on Xbox One for $9.99. Xenon Valkyrie Plus is a roguelike with many RPG elements in which you will have to get to the deepest part of a moon and finish the plans of a wicked witch. You'll be able to get as many weapons randomly as you fight in a world that is created every time you play. This game, first time I played it, it felt like a mix between Splunky, which I love, and Vertical Drop Heroes, which I love, which means I really love Xenon Valkyrie Plus. Pixel style visuals, retro style look to it. You start the game in roguelike fashion. You enter a world, you take out the enemies, you pick up weapons, you collect money, you move on to the next stage. Everything's randomly created. So every time you play, it's completely different. Go through a couple stages, hit a boss battle, kill the boss, move on to the next world, rinse, repeat. Obviously, after bosses, you are able to, if you have enough of the one material that you collect, you're able to create a teleport so that you could pretty much skip the first world and move on to the next one and so on as you get through the game. So, you know, the more you play, the further you get, the less you're going to have to replay the early stages. Although a lot of times I still went back and replayed those early stages just so I wasn't jumping halfway into the game at a low level. I felt it was better to just replay those earlier stages, collect money, level myself up, and move on instead of just trying to struggle in later stages right away. In true roguelike fashion, there's, you know, hidden bosses, hidden missions you could do, like Binding of Isaac, how there's just so much hidden shit you could do in the game, or Shiz with Enter the Gungeon. He's been going through all those crazy hidden things to do and different endings, stuff like that. They have that in this game as well. So if you want to dig into the lore and the world of this game and find all the secrets and stuff, it will take you a good chunk of time. Gameplay, 2D plane, just go through levels, kill everything, collect what they drop, and move on. It is satisfying. It plays really well. I have basically no gripes with the game except it kicks my ass. It's a tough one for sure.
Can I point something out since you said Cowcat Games?
Mm-hmm.
You know what else that that guy did, right?
Yeah, Demetrios.
Demetrios. As soon as you said that, I was like, wait a second. That's a huge jump in game genres for one dude.
Well, he's publishing this one. He didn't develop this one. He's publishing
did
this
he
one.
Not do it? I thought he developed it.
Developed by Diabolical Mind.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes a little more sense because I was just like, how did that happen? Because I know this is, that Cowcat is a one-man show. And so I was like, okay, what?
Yeah, see?
It all makes a little more sense now.
Publishing is fun. But yeah, this yeah. game, $10, this is an absolute no-brainer buy it. This game is ungodly fun. There's a shitload to do in the game. It is incredibly addictive. And despite how many times you die in this game, you'll always be saying to yourself, fuck it, one more run. Because that's what I did the other night. And I played for 4 hours.
I was about to say, and then before you know it, it's 4 a.m. and you have to get up in 30 minutes and you're fucked.
yeah, really, really. But it's fucking awesome. People know how much I enjoyed Vertical Drop Heroes, considering it's one of our Hall of Famer games. So just to hear me comparing it to Vertical Drop Heroes should give you the indication that this is worth picking up. So if you're a fan of roguelikes, if you enjoyed Splunky, if you enjoyed Vertical Drop Heroes, if you match any of those, drop the $10 on this one. It is awesome.
Sounds good.
Cool. Next game is called Shopkeep, developed by Strange Fire Games, published by Excalibur Games. This one is coming out March 2nd on Xbox One for $12.99. So we're taking a look at this one pretty early. Embark on creating your own fantasy retail business in Shopkeep. Starting from scratch with a few shelves and limited stock availability, plan your displays and price your wares competitively to attract and keep customers returning. Work out the perfect product selection and pitch the price just right to succeed in this rough, tough trade. Cole, tell me about it.
Have you ever played an RPG and been like, I wonder what the Shopkeep guys... like the merchant's day is like, how does he get through the day? Because if you haven't, then you have no empathy. Those shopkeeps have it rough. And I can tell you, because I've spent an awful lot of time being one of those in this game. The entire premise is pretty simple. You have your little shop inside an RPG game, and you start off with basic, like, warriors just coming through your area, and they'll have minor needs, like, oh, they'll need health potions and mana potions and weapons, and as you service your community, different types of,
different yeah, sausage types vendor of... Joe, fuck yeah. Someone listens.
God damn it. There's different types of customers who will come through, like mages and elves, if you will. I think they're called druids instead of elves, but they'll become semantics. Available for you. Yeah, you'll be able to unlock them, and they all have different types of needs. And on top of that, certain items might be more popular on certain days. So you have to, you know, use your money that you earn from marking up your beginner stuff, like your health potions and your mana potions, so that you can fulfill the greater needs of your new audience as you grow. And this will leave you to frantically running around trying to keep the shelves stocked, because they will buy up literally everything if you're pricing it right. Before you know it, there's just shit like falling everywhere. These guys are pretty brutal, too. Your customers are shitheads. They'll just knock stuff in the floor. And if your merchandise is laying in the floor, they won't bend over and pick that up if they need a health potion. They'll just shrug and walk back out and not buy a fucking health potion, even though it's laying right there. It was like taking care of my kids. Like, it's on the floor. Bend over and pick that shit up for yourself. No, they won't. You have to pick that shit up and put it back on the shelf.
Listen here, you little son of a bitch.
In addition to that, if they're not fans of your pricing structure and they really need that health potion, they're going to run out the door with it. And you get to chase them down and go into combat mode. And then you can either hit them with your axe or hit them with some lightning and leave their little toasted corpse right there in the courtyard. Other customers might not be a fan of you leaving the corpses behind, though.
Yeah, fuck them.
So you have to whip out your broom and sweep away the bodies.
This game sounds hilarious.
It's a little ridiculous. And you will find that sweeping them away after you've chopped them down is a little cathartic. Sometimes I would just like go through the day. At some points, it's just crazy busy and you can't keep up with it all anyway. So you might as well just like shut down the shoplifters and leave them lay until you can catch your breath and then go back and sweep them all away. And be like, look, at least the dead bodies gave me a break because people didn't want to shop there. They thought they were going to get cut down.
Nice. It sounds like a lot of fun. Any negatives so far?
It's ugly as sin. The game is just really not pretty. It's very, it's blocky and just kind of cheap graphics, if you will. It's not anything that's going to shake your world. I think, though, it kind of adds to the charm after a while. And you're just like, yeah, everything's a little clunky here. But it is just not a pretty game. I feel bad shitting on a game's appearance. But that's the only thing I found to complain about. The controls, too, are not always ideal. Like, certain items can only sit on certain types of spots. So if you build a counter, you can only have 2 large items, but you have 9 small items on the counter. And it's not always easy to navigate the controller to, like, say, the back spots where you can fit. It'll be like, you know, 3 rows of 3. And sometimes the arrow just doesn't want to go to the middle back spot, no matter what you do. That's something where on Steam, it's probably not a big an issue with, like, you know, a mouse. With a controller, it's kind of a pain in the ass. It could be smoothed over a little bit.
No.
But it was forgivable. Like, it was just kind of a thing I got used to, and I was just kind of not ever expecting myself to fit anything into that back slot because I knew it was such a pain to get to it. And I just kind of worked around it. But it would be nice if the controller was a little more functional in that regard. Or if it was, I don't know, if maybe, I guess if you didn't do like I did and put it up against the wall where you couldn't get to that back end anyway, it would have been an issue.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Take a little more care in how you plan your shop, and you might not have that problem.
Nice. So $13 on this one. What do you think of it?
This is a solid buy it. I had a lot of fun. The achievements are fairly easy. There's some grindy ones, you know, for having certain amounts of money or having your shop open for a certain amount of time. But otherwise, it's just a lot of fun. I really found myself like, you know what? I don't want to do anything today. I'm just going to let my shop run. Because I eventually get to a point where, like, you have bots that help you. And so my bots were doing everything, and I was just, like, putting the controller down and just kind of watching to make sure nobody stole my shit. And then if they did, I'd cut them down.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Sounds like one of those ugly as sin but fun as hell kind of games.
Yeah, you forgive. You forgive the homely factor just because you're enjoying it.
Nice. I know the developer is working on a Shopkeep 2 as well. I have no idea if that one will come to console or not. Apparently on Steam, there's a lot of people pissed off that he kind of stopped work on the original to start on a sequel. But, you know, you can't support one game forever, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't follow it that much on Steam because I don't play on Steam, so I don't know the whole story. Yeah. There all I know is that it sounds fun on Xbox, and that's what matters.
I enjoyed it. I was happy. I'd play too. I hope it looks better, but I'd play it.
Cool. And again, that comes out March 2nd on Xbox One. If you pre-order it, you could actually save a little bit of money. Instead of $12.99, you can pre-order for $11.69. So, 69. Oh, man. Anyway, one final game to talk about tonight called Defender's Quest Valley of the Forgotten DX, developed and published by Level Up Labs. It released February 20th on PS4, February 21st on Xbox One for $14.99. Defender's Quest is a tower defense RPG hybrid. Think Final Fantasy Tactics meets tower defense. Focuses on three things: tactical depth, customization, and story. That means no random encounters, no spiky-haired emo kids, no forced time sinks, and no tedious repetitive battles. That pretty much explains the game completely for the most part. it is a tower defense game with RPG mechanics. There's a storyline to it, so it's not just go level to level to level. There's, you know, an actual story and history to the game where, I hate trying to talk about a story of a game without ruining anything.
Yeah.
But basically you are able to live in a world between life and death. And there is someone who is able to turn people into the dead, and you have to basically enter that realm between life and death, bring people with you, and defeat those, the enemies, and prevent them from killing your hero. In true tower defense form, you'll see a path on the ground. You have to set your troops out on, you know, select areas around the trails. Each character has their own unique weapons and attacks. There are archers. There are berserkers, which are just, you know, straight up attack. There are mages in the game, so various different classes that each have their own unique spells, abilities. After each battle, characters can level up. You can I enjoy the fact that there's a tower defense game where your characters can level up, so as you go through the game, get stronger, you can go back to the earlier stages and just beat motherfuckers up instead of struggling through things. I know the description says no tedious repetitive battles, but as someone who enjoys the grind in RPGs, I would go back and replay battles. It's fun for me. I like grinding and making myself a little more powerful than others. Campaign is a couple hours long, trying to recall how many stages were in the game. I'd say 20, 30 stages, somewhere in that realm. It doesn't sound like too much, but there's actually a new game plus mode to it as well that introduces side quests, additional areas, obviously a tougher experience overall. It's just a lot of fun. If you're into tower defense games, I think this is definitely one of the better ones out there. It's nice to see a tower defense game with actual substance and meat to it instead of just go play a stage, get 3 stars, play a stage.
Yeah. Build this, protect that, bye.
Yeah, pretty much. I enjoy the achievements in the game too. There's some fun stuff in there. I know I don't usually focus on achievements too much while covering reviews. There are achievements in the game for beating the game without recruiting any random generic characters. As you go through the story, you'll meet, you know, named characters that will join your party, and, you know, one for each of the different classes. And when you get to different towns, you can recruit random people as well. It can help somewhat make stages easier as you'll have more troops at your disposal. But, you know, first off, it'll void those achievements, so you won't get beating a new game or new game plus without the random recruits. You won't get those. But it also makes it so the troops that you do put out won't be as powerful as they can be. Each of the troops has 5 different levels or tiers of their abilities, and when you summon them, they only have like level 1 or level 2, and you have to spend I don't know what the currency is. It's like mana points or something that you pay a certain amount to summon them and then to level them up. And as you go through and kill monsters, you'll earn more so you can power up your troops more. Obviously, the more troops you have out, the less powerful they can all be, because there's only so much money in the game. I ended up making it through the entire original campaign with just the stock characters. So yeah, I'm awesome. Each of the stages has three different difficulty levels. So lottery playability, hidden items in the game. The new game plus, like I said, just adds a shitload more to the game with the side quests and the extra areas, each again having three different difficulty levels. I think there's like a level 50 or level 40 cap in the game. So there's a lot you can just grind and get more powerful, go back, replay. There's a lot to do in this game, like an ungodly amount. And I think I've spent more time on this game than anything I've covered in quite a while, because I don't want to stop playing it.
Wow.
Yeah, and I cover a lot of shit. So to find a game that actually like pulls me in and keeps me addicted for multiple days and multiple play sessions, it's good to find something like that. And it's, yeah, like I said, it's good to find a tower defense game that does something different and has a story and has characters. My only real gripes with the game is presentation wise, it feels kind of generic, kind of cheap. It feels like something like even menus that you would have seen in like an RPG maker. It just feels very basic. It doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles and presentation, but the content is there to back it up. So I can't fault it too much. You know, maybe in a sequel, the menus and everything else will be a little more refined and a little more stylish looking, but what's there now, I absolutely fucking love. So for $15, I am throwing my whole heart and soul behind Defender's Quest. Buy this game. It is awesome.
Damn, that's a pretty high praise.
It is, because it's an awesome game and it deserves it. That's how it is. That's how I do. But that is it for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for hanging out and listening and keeping us company. Thanks again to Chris for dropping by and talking about Moss. I can't wait to get my hands on the full game. It is so goddamn cute. So fun. The 10-minute demo was just not enough. When the demo ended, yeah, and a giant snake came out from the shadows, I was ready for a battle, and then it's like, thanks for playing. I'm like, you sons of bitches.
I'm going to hold out hope for us to see it, you know, on Xbox some way, somehow, because it looked really cool and I'd love to try it.
I wonder if there's any consideration of making a non-VR version of the game. I don't know if it would translate as well in non-VR, because just the interaction, right, with the world, I don't really know how they would do it without it, but I don't know. Mixed reality on Windows 10, maybe Carnage will get his wish eventually. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, that is it for this episode. Cole, do you have any final words to end the show?
I don't ever have anything fancy to say.
Oh, fucking, you got to start thinking of these. Like, you've listened to the show long enough. You know the drill. I always ask.
You know what happens, though? I think it's a case of you guys interrupt me so much that I just expect if I did have any final words, you'd cut me off.
We should just, every episode when I ask for your final words, just make fun of Carnage.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. Carnage cool. So, can be the whipping boy.
Do you have any final words to end the show?
For Carnage?
We'll be right back.